This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode today dedicated to what was unfolding 75 years ago off of Taiwan, known then as Formosa in the Philippine Sea. The USS Houston, a ship renamed in tribute to another cruiser that had vanished in the middle of the night 2 years earlier, was itself staring at a fate similar to its namesake's. In fact, if you're into the details and you'd like to read the official damage report from the USS Houston's torpedoing, I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It was a unique case study because most ships that were struck by a torpedo where the Houston was, it detonated against the bottom amidships midway between the centerline keel and the starboard bilge keel, most of them wouldn't be available to study because they'd be at the bottom of the sea. That torpedo hit right as the Houston was listing to port during a high-speed turn. And you heard the man executing that turn, helmsman Jonas Hofer, explain what he experienced. The captain gave the abandoned ship order, and about 80% of the crew did abandon ship. A skeleton crew remained as the Houston became a very slow-moving target, limping along under tow with the battle raging on around them. Once things settled down, that remaining crew carried out a burial at sea for those shipmates killed in the near sinking. And Jonas Hofer found himself right in the middle of that as well.
Well, we had a burial of about 40 guys in that time. And what we would do is then, you would, if the guy was dead, you'd check him out and you'd put an M on their forehead. And then you'd take a 5-inch shell and put it between their legs and wrap canvas around twice and sew it up. And then you'd put them on a board like this here against the ship's railing, and then I'd play taps, and they'd dump it like that, and the canvas would go out from underneath the top cover going out there.
And they would slide into the water.
You couldn't haul them all in, you know, because you didn't know when you're going to come in to shore and that, and they would, our power was all out. We had no air refrigeration or that anymore. And there were about, I suppose, from 40 to 60 guys that were still in the water down there, and you couldn't get them out. This was all topside guys, and we buried 10 at a time. So we did four times, so I say there's 40 that were buried.
And you just answered my next question. I was putting two and two together, saying if you're the head of the bugle crew on this ship, that you might have had to play taps. What was that like for a burial at sea, to be the guy where everyone's attention is on you, and you know what a somber situation this is?
I always said you didn't have to worry about a vibrato. It came automatically. You had to really concentrate, you know, not to think that these are your friends that you're burying now and that you wanted to play the taps right. You had to really think about that there. And afterwards, the officers all came up and thanked you and figure, how did he keep your cool on that there? Well, I had a hard time.
And he would have to keep his cool again on October 16th, 1944, when 2 days after the initial torpedo strike, the crippled cruiser was struck again.
A Betty, a Japanese plane, twin-engine plane, came and followed the oil slick, which is in the water, and then came out on the side and came in, dropped the torpedo, and we had no guns except 20 millimeter that was on the main deck, maybe 20 of those. And those guys opened up and they got the airplane, but here the fish was down the water, right? And the second torpedo hit under the hangar deck in back where our two airplanes were and just broke that all up. Luckily, we had a small fire there, but it did not get into the gasoline, so we were saved that way. But we did have some fires in that aboard ship.
So at this point, you're still thinking that this ship is going to make it. But I know I'm bouncing around on you here. Before you pick it up there, I think a lot of people are saying, man, a teenager at the wheel of a ship in battle with torpedoes coming at you, getting hit by torpedoes, listening to the captain, seeing what's going on. Were you nervous? Were you scared? What in the world does that feel like?
No, you just follow orders because you've been steering the ship otherwise than that there. If he says 30 degrees right rudder, full right rudder, left to that, or come to 278, you'd say 278, you'd come to it and says, sir, We're on 278. Tell them that. So you just reported the officer wasn't. He could get, because he could see the torpedoes coming in. And the second one, of course, we knew when this Betty dropped that torpedo, we're going to get hit because it was so close.
Did you actually see it?
We saw the trail in the water, yeah, coming right at us. And, of course, we were dead in the water then. That was the second.
Yeah, you're being pulled along by a tug, going very slow.
And our steering aft, the steering was out, so they manually got the rudder straightened out, and that's where it was at. We couldn't, the engineering and that was all underwater. So there, the guys were still in there.
So when you saw that torpedo, the wake in the water coming at you.
I didn't see it, but the officer did. Yeah. The captain saw it, yeah.
Well, maybe it's better you didn't see it.
Probably. Well, I was waiting then, and he says, somebody in there, another officer, said, we're going to catch another torpedo on that then. So we kind of braced ourselves for that one. But the first one, I didn't know. When that ship lifted up and fell like that, I didn't know what happened then.
And where were you when the second one hit?
I was on the bridge. I was on the bridge watching for other airplanes and that there, reporting them, yeah.
And how long did it take after that hit before you knew this time it was abandoned ship for good?
Oh, I'd say about a half an hour after that, the captain said abandoned ship. But to this day, I don't know when I left the ship. I have tried to think of that. I've been asked about it. And I know Dyke and myself got together in the water then. And when I came to in the water, there were about 25 of us in the water and that. And you'll think this is funny, and I think it is too, is we started singing some hymns. And the hymns I remember we sang, one of them was, "There Shall Be Showers of Blessing." Now, why would you sing a song like that? It just seems crazy to me. Why would you sing there's? But I guess because most of the sailors knew that song. We sang that and some other hymns and that there in the water. And then it got dark and we got parted. And pretty soon we weren't close. And Dyke and myself, we tied ourselves together with our belts. And we were in the water. And then the next day the sun came up. During the night, we saw some ships come close. And we were afraid, and first they'd go over us, but they didn't. But we were afraid to yell out because we didn't know if they're Japanese or ours because there were so many ships in the air, Japanese and that. And we were pretty close to Formosa there too, you know, 80 miles about that time. They figure that during those 2 days, we were towed about 80 miles on the water.
Couple questions. You said when you came to in the water, so did you, and you said you don't remember when you went off the ship, did you get off the ship under your own power, or were you blown off the ship, or you don't know?
I don't know. I think I got off my own, but I can't remember going over the side of the ship. And then it was after I was in the water, Dyke swam up to me, and I recognized him, so we tied ourselves together with our belts, and then we wanted to stay together.
And did you have a Mae West or any kind of flotation device?
I had two of them. I had a Mae West, and then I had the other one, which is a rubber one that has a little hand. You pull it, and it blows up, and it goes underneath you. The Mae West, after 3 hours, was worthless. It was taking us down that night. And so we both took our Mae West and just dropped, and they sunk, actually. But these rubber ones we had, those were good. Those stayed. And they, if they went down, had a leak in them, they also had something you could blow them. And that's what kept us up till the next day, yeah.
How many hours were you in the water?
Between 14 and 16. I don't know exactly when we went in. I know I was picked up at about 10 o'clock next morning. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, while the sun was going down, when we got that second torpedo. And I just don't know, like I say, I cannot reckon at all of when I went in the water. But I know there, because Dyke swam up, and we swam together and tied ourselves together, and we sang these songs in the water. I know that much. And then during the night, we got parted, you know. In the morning, when we got picked up, there was nobody close to us. And the USS Grayson was still in a battle then. The ships were still fighting there again. They'd gotten into battle again. And what they did with our ship, they towed it as bait for the Japanese planes to come out, and then our battleships and those would, and our pilots would shoot them down. But they missed this one Betty that came in, saw our oil slick, and came in the side and gave us the next torpedo.
I've talked to a few guys who have had to abandon ship and who have had to survive the water for some time. And in different spots, there were different hazards of the water. What did you see? What did you experience floating in the water? I mean, were there things burning around you? Were there things to hold on to? Did you have to fear sharks at all? What did you have to deal with?
There was a lot of wood and stuff and seats and different things in the water. There was a lot of that stuff in the water, floating metal and some metal and that there. See, the tornado had went through there about 3 days before that, and so we had white caps go over our heads all the time, and you was wet continue. But the water temperature was 87 degrees. So it was warm when you started out. But by the next day, when you'd been in it over 12 hours, I think I was in it, I'd say 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in between. I was so weak from being in the water so long, and of course we hadn't eaten in maybe 30 hours, that I couldn't even climb the ropes on the ship. What the Grayson did is they couldn't stop, because then they'd get a torpedo. So they kept going, but they put a boat. And the boat took one circle, picked up eight of us. And then while they were picking us up and we was getting on, a torpedo went under the ship. The sailors said it had been set a little too deep, maybe for a battle wagon or aircraft carrier. So then when we got up, of course, and got on, two sailors came down and got me under the arms and brought me over the, because I couldn't climb. I was just so tired and that. And then Dyke says, well, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there and prayed. And there were about 100 sailors around us, plus officers and that. And I can remember when we prayed, they were just all quiet. There was really respect. And I really appreciated that when we, and so after I prayed, I looked up kind of and I saw these guys all standing with their hats over there like that there and looking down that. So we were really respected because we had the Bible class, I think. I think that's why. I don't think they would have done it otherwise.
And along those lines, maybe some folks aren't familiar with what the navigators were as they were founded during that time period. How extensive was that program on your ship?
Well, the officers and the captain was for ours, for us having those there. Because they figured that the more guys that followed the Bible, the less problems they'd have in shore patrol and stuff like that, which was right, yeah. So we would have every Monday night from 8 till 9 o'clock, we would have Bible studies and go over some of the verse memorized the guys were, and find out how they're getting along in their Christian life and that. Of course, we had a lot of booze. You know, the guys called us old preachers and Bible thumpers, and they had a whole bunch of names. But in the water there, they swam up to us and were all very good to us and that. And even aboard ship, like I say, while we prayed there and that there, of course, they realized, well, here these eight guys were just saved out of the water and that there, so they have something to be thankful for. And we were. And then what you did in your Bible studies and that, we started a Timothy program, which the navigators did. You would take one guy out from the other sailors and that, and you would work with him for about 6 months and just tutor him and get him into the Bible study and that. And then 6 months later, he did it too, so you were doubled. Dawson Trotman had it figured out that if everybody would do this every 2 years, get two like this, and then four, and then 16, in 13 years, everybody in the world would have been a navigator. Well, some of the guys never did, so you fall through that there. We started out with the two of us and started, and by the time the ship was sunk, we had about 30. We had about 30 guys that came to our meetings every Monday night and that.
And there's quite a story behind those weekly meetings, too. We're going to hear that when we come back. Everything you're hearing about today was unfolding in real time 75 years ago in the Philippine Sea off of Formosa. Check out the photos and additional links online at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.